Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode here at the Damage Report. Today is a Tuesday, and while the news is as tragic as you would expect on any random day chosen in American recent political history, what is exciting is our guest, because joining us for the first time, not overall, but as a co-host, Amanda Nguyen, civil rights activist, joins us on the show. Amanda, how's it going?
Going, but I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having
me. It is going. So I'm very excited to have you here. You know, you appeared on the show just a couple of weeks ago on a talking about a subject that we're going to be talking about on the show, actually. But for people who might not be familiar with you from that, can you tell the audience a little bit about your work?
Yeah, totally. You know, I'm a civil rights activist. I run an organization called RISE. We accelerate civil rights movements. Essentially, we help train community organizers who work on a whole host of issues. Sexual violence is a large part of our work, and recently anti-Asian hate crimes.
Exactly, and obviously incredibly timely there. Also, I learned recently in my research, nominated for a Nobel Prize, correct?
Yes, that's right.
See, if that was true of me, it would be in my lower third on the screen. It would in place of my Twitter, it would just be once nominated for, but you're very humble about that. So appreciate right. that. And you taking the time out. I'm sure you must be very busy.
Excited to be here.
So everyone, thank you for being here, regardless of what platform you're on. Please hit the like button and share the stream so that people know we're live. And we've got a lot that we're gonna be talking about. Two different mass shootings. We're gonna be getting into that. Sidney Powell's recent legal defense, how the rich avoid taxes. There's a lot of material we're gonna be covering. But as we go through it, if you have questions or comments or concerns, you can feel free to leave us comments or super chats, tweets, anything like that. And we will be responding to those as we go along. So thank you in advance for that. And with that, why don't we jump into our first topic? Yesterday, the United States saw yet another mass shooting with 10 people, including a police officer, being killed on Monday when a gunman opened fire in a supermarket in the Colorado College City of Boulder in one of several mass shootings in the US over the last week. I believe it's 7 over 7 days, assuming that you have a fairly restrictive definition of what a mass shooting is. We have to in the United States to make the term have any meaning whatsoever because gun violence is so pervasive. Now, the situation is, of course, developing fast. The suspect is in custody, but authorities have not shared any information on his identity, because of course it's a him, the type of weapon used or any possible motive. Although one senior law enforcement source told CNN the weapon used in the shooting was an AR-15 style rifle. Now we don't know that for sure, but it's a mass shooting, so there's a pretty good shot. We've heard that the suspect is a 21-year-old that lived in a suburb near that area, although I don't know if that's considered 100% confirmed at this point. And so we will be finding out more about the identities of those who were killed, regrettably, in this tragic shooting. But we should also understand, as we'll get into throughout the course of the hour, that this exists in the context that the massacre at the King Super store comes less than a week after shootings at 3 spas in the Atlantic area left 8 people dead. And that is 7 shootings in which at least 4 people were injured or killed. And we do this thing, Amanda, where we have to be very selective in terms of which acts of horrendous mass violence actually merit national attention, because the news would just be those if we paid equal attention to all of them. But anyway, what did you think about this most recent tragic event?
Well said, my gosh. I mean, I feel like there could be right now a script that you could just, like, some AI could just print it out, which is like, this is what the media is gonna say, this is what our politicians are gonna say, this is, you know. And oh man, have you seen those Onion articles, you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, where the headline is the same exact script. And I just,
I believe it's only nation where this happens can't tell how it happened again or something like that. Yeah,
that's exactly that headline. My God, I obviously wasn't even done processing the last mass shooting, you know, and I know we're gonna go into it later, but I woke up and I was like, I don't even know if it's desensitization at this point, right? Like, I'm just so heartbroken. And how did you feel? You know, I feel like I'm looping in the same loop, which is like, okay, let's look at the news. Oh my God, let's learn about the victims. Let's learn about this. What are we gonna do about it? It's the same conversation. So how did you feel?
I mean, obviously a horrendous tragedy, although I'm not gonna lie to the audience. I am and have been for so long so desensitized, obviously. And yeah. And in the exact way that you so rightly point out, not just about the event, which it's horrible enough that the event happened, it's horrible enough that one could become desensitized to it. But it almost feels like, and we talk about this a lot, and we're gonna demonstrate it on the show today. It almost feels like a weird form of being in the Matrix and seeing the code. You can see every branching path of how every single organization and individual is going to respond to this, myself included. I know exactly what we're gonna say. We're gonna acknowledge in real time that it's pointless, that it's futile, that we've been through this so many times, but we're going to have to do it because I don't know any other way to respond. So anyway, look, we're gonna say that it's horrendous. We're going to have a motivation, by the way, and motivations don't often, I think, get discussed enough. Whatever I say, whatever you say, I can only speak for myself, but I assume the motivation is, wouldn't it be nice to have fewer mass shootings in the future? But I can guarantee that there are many people who greet the news of another mass shooting, and that is not the thing that's lurking in the back of their mind, regardless of how they responded. In a tweet recently, I broke down some of the ways that right wingers often respond. Sometimes they just duck their head down and don't say anything. Sometimes they offer thoughts and prayers. Sometimes they just come and defend the guns. But the goal of all of those is unified. It is not stopping mass shootings in the future. That is not the thing that they're worried about. They're worried about gun control. And it's sort of an irrational fear anyway, because we live in America. They're never gonna pass any gun control. But that is the fear. That's what they're worried about. And we're gonna demonstrate that in a minute, but I wanted to give you another opportunity to jump in.
No, I think so much about the rhetoric that plays, especially for people who feel so strongly about it, isn't the actual policy. It's their identity. And so, you know, how can we actually say, hey, these are the facts. That's why the facts don't matter for so many people. And I don't know if you have a lot of international friends, but every single time this happens, I hear from my international friends and they're like, what is going on? You know, and so have that perspective a little bit and be able to like think outside of a very American framework for a second has helped me in some way process through this and you know, kind of get myself outside of that matrix. But yeah, we're still working through it. And I know everyone is hurting so badly. I hope, I really, really hope that one day we can sit down and have a conversation with people to move forward.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't wanna go off on too many tangents because there's so much that we have to talk about, but I just get so frustrated. Like seemingly common sense things that one might say. And again, I don't know some of the details of this. We don't know for sure exactly what weapon they had. But I do know that it doesn't matter for some people. If the dude filmed himself immediately beforehand saying, I'm doing this because I believe that more people need to die, and isn't it great that we have guns, and oh, it's so awesome that it was able to get an AR-15, I'm gonna kill so many more people with that. If that came out, it wouldn't change a single mind. So when I say, hey, wouldn't it be nice if we're gonna live in a country where frequently people, generally younger white males, decide that they wanna shoot as many people as possible, shouldn't we make that tough? Shouldn't we make it so that they have to resort to weapons that aren't really good at killing lots of people? And so I'll tweet something like that, which seems sort of like a benign common sense thing to say. And someone will respond with, if they want the weapon, they'll get the weapon. Okay, but let's actually follow that logic. So the idea is there's no point in banning an AR-15 because you'll just get one if you want one. Try that in practice, how easy it is. But let's say, okay, an AR-15. Okay, but what about something better? Let's say I want an M51 crew, like belt-fed machine gun. That's even better at killing a lot of people. Well, by your logic, I can just get one, right? I'll just cruise down to Walmart or something. I want a tank. I want an RPG. I want a flamethrower. Can I just get these things? Well, thanks to Elon Musk, I can get a flamethrower. But aside from that, can I just get these things? No, because it's inconvenient, and it should be. At the very least, even if somehow these weirdo young white supremacists were capable of managing the black market of illegal weapons, let's make it take a while, because then at least we might be able to catch them. But there's no point in having this conversation because nobody that says they're just gonna get it is actually thinking about that. What they're thinking is, I wanna be able to get it. I wanna keep the ones I have, I wanna get more eventually. And so every part of this, Amanda, is so frustrating. I apologize. This is literally the first thing you come on the show to talk about.
But so many people relate to you and like speak it because people, I mean, we all feel really isolated right now, right? We're at home, you know, movement restrictions, whatever. So yeah, please say it because the rest of the country can live vicariously through us right now.
They can. Okay, well, let's briefly go through some frustrating stuff. How are some right wingers responding to the shooting? Well, the NRA, which traditionally they just stop tweeting for about 3 days after a mass shooting, which means that they don't actually get to tweet very much because this is America. Instead, they decided to tweet this yesterday. And I swear to God, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So credit to them for actually including the militia part, which most people who spout off about the Second Amendment pretend doesn't exist there. But then they lose all of that credit and way more because they just tweeted out the Second Amendment after a dude who probably loves the Second Amendment went and shot a bunch of people. That's pretty horrendous, Amanda. I guess they don't have to pretend to care about human life anymore.
Yeah, we're beyond that. That's so clear from them. Mm-hmm. You know, why do we even have these like masks on? You know, it really is about like, this is me, I want control versus this is you and you want control. And we're just talking past each other. So at this point, we're gonna call it for what it is. This is, you know, people being okay with mass murder. That's what it is.
It is. And sometimes there's a more cowardly version of what the NRA just did. So Jemele Hill, she put this quote up from the Colorado State Shooting Association that says, quote, "There will be a time for the debate on gun laws. There will be a time for the discussion on motives. There will be a time for a conversation on how this could have been prevented. But today is not the time." And she correctly points out it never is. So this is the like go-to tactic of the person who doesn't want change. Well, at some point, not now. Okay, well, that's fair. You're right. It did just happen. So not now. How about next Thursday around 2-ish? I'm free. Colorado Shooting Association. You want to talk then? It'll have been a nice buffer. Now, understand that, of course, there will be like 10 more mass shootings by then. But at some point, we have to do it. You're implying that there will be a time. So I think Thursday 2-ish is a great time. Pacific, obviously, your Colorado will adapt the time based on that. But no, there's no time. There's no time, like when are we supposed to talk about getting rid of the Electoral College? Not near elections, certainly. Yep. Might as well wait until nobody talks about it or cares about it anymore. It's just, it's also by the numbers and it feels like a play. And so we have a part to fill in this play. So I'm going to point out to people, most of whom already know this, that the US has a couple of massive problems that almost certainly lead to these problems. So for instance, did you know that the US has the highest number of civilian firearms per 100 residents? Of course you do, but I'm gonna remind you, we've got over 120 guns for every 100 residents, making the war-torn country of Yemen look like they just can't scrounge together a couple of ARs. So we've got a lot of that, meaning that though we have less than 5% of the world's population, we have 45% of all the world's privately held firearms. And totally unrelated, we have by far the most homicides by firearm per 1 million people. You can take a look at this chart. We have 6 times what they have in Canada, 16 times what they have in Germany, 29 times what they have in Australia. And that is a place that is littered with animals that will kill you at the blink of an eye. And yet we're the ones who have a lot of guns that end up shooting each other. Even though, and this is I think the most important thing to point out, it is not that we have a lot of guns and a lot of people die from guns because against all reason, we're really crime ridden. Take a look at this. We don't have comparable rates of violent crime to places considering the level of killings that we have. There are lots of places that are far less safe on average where they don't manage to kill a lot of people all the time with guns because they don't all have access, easy, quick, unrestricted access to guns. You combine all of these things and what do you think you would get? You'll get something like modern day America, honestly. Any thoughts, Amanda?
Yeah, I mean, what you said earlier about that age old tactic of saying it's not the right time, it's not that I've heard that in so many different derivatives for literally every single type of change that my activists and I try to do. It's like, oh, you know, well, not today, maybe at a more appropriate time, you know, And there's never a more convenient season for change. I think that's Martin Luther King. And if you want change, then do it now, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, people who say that are protecting the status quo. That's what they're doing.
Yeah.
And they are doing that because they genuinely are afraid of the power that people have. I think a huge part in status quo resetting the balance and or keeping the balance is gaslighting people to forget their own power, you know? So like, hey, you know, just chill for a second. Just delay it for a little bit. And they do that because it's not only that they're afraid of, you know, the actual policy change, but they're afraid of what it means for their own power, because power does not give up power, right? And so yeah, just remember that when you're demanding change, it's always a fine line when you're trying to straddle, like, okay, diplomacy versus, you know, you want to be able to create traction, right? So you have to get people to the table. But at some point, you're just going to have to remember that they have their own constituents in their mind. They're serving their own people. Their interests are not the same as yours, even though they're trying to say that it is.
Yeah. Power's not going to give itself up, and money isn't either. And whether it's the NRA getting money from the gun manufacturers, or Republican and some Democratic elected officials getting money from the NRA and from the gun manufacturers, they're not going to give that up willingly. And then let a little thing like tons of dead American civilians get in the way of this amazing grift that they've got set up. But in the same way that Amanda was talking about one of these misconceptions we often heard said, I want to respond to another one. And this is sent in by a super chat from Thorin. And Thorin, love you. Thank you for the super chat. As I'm going to demonstrate, couldn't disagree with you more. He says, it's not the guns, it's the mental health crisis we have. A person who wants to commit mass murder will find a way to do it. So Thorin is right. We do have a mental health crisis. It's a big problem. Aside from that, though, I don't agree with Thorin. Because sure, a person who wants to kill people can kill people with stuff other than guns. There are places where there have been mass stabbings and things like that. That does happen. But there's a reason that people here use guns. And there's a reason they use the guns that they do generally. It's because they're much better at killing people. I mean, this is sort of a morbid thought, but if you were to go up to someone hunkered down behind a Walmart, you know, shelf while a mass shooter is stalking through, and you were to ask him, hey, if you could, would you want to swap his gun out for a knife? I don't think anyone would be like, what's the difference? It's all the same. It's not all the same. They pick the gun because the gun is the best way to do it. Can I kill someone with a baseball bat? Yes. Can I kill 15 people in 3 minutes with a baseball bat? Probably not. And so I would prefer to have them try to use a knife or a baseball bat. I don't want any of that violence, but if it's going to happen, I want them to be with the worst guns possible, the worst weapons possible. And so thank you for your super chat, but I just don't agree. It's not just one problem, you're right. It's a combination of multiple ones, but. And so someone's saying if you took the knives away, they'd use sporks. And how many people do you think you're going to kill with a spork? Seriously, like jokes aside, I don't know if you're joking. I just. How many times have we done this on the damage report, on the Young Turks? How many mass shootings? And how many more will we? We will have the same conversation. Maybe someday we'll have it with Amanda again on the show. We'll be blessed enough to talk about a mass shooting in Denver, Tallahassee, Sacramento. I don't know. Maybe it'll be in a city you're in right now. You know, and to that point, let's talk about the last one, actually. Let's go through all of the shooting stuff in one go. We are less than a week out from the string of shootings that killed a bunch of people in and around Atlanta, predominantly women of Asian descent. And you know, we have Amanda Nguyen on the show. And Amanda, when you were on the show just a couple of weeks ago, it was to talk about this string of harassment and violence against this community. And then what do you know? It reaches what I can only hope is the peak, the worst instance. But we haven't had a chance to talk about that in general terms. So I imagine the last week has been pretty rough.
Yeah, it feels like a betrayal. It's validation in the worst possible way. Because for the past several months, I've been essentially bearing my soul out to this country saying, how many more lives is it going to take in order for people to take our stories seriously? How many people need to be killed? It's going to happen. I'm telling you what the consequence is if we don't do something about this. And then it happened, right? And so, you know, I heard about the shooting while I was on a live interview, and it was so heartbreaking. The reporter was like Sorry, you know, we have breaking news. We're hearing now that there has been a mass shooting targeting Asian women. There have been 2 confirmed dead, no 4, no 6, no 8. And the reporter then asked me, in light of these shootings, do you think there still is progress? First of all, that was a very tough question in that moment. And second, I mean, like, what other answer can I give than yes, we have to talk about this. Activism can't stop on this. So look, people are grieving right now. I literally couldn't sleep that night. I just literally like walked around DC. A bunch of people started reaching out. So I'm really glad. Thank you to the people who reached out. If you have Asian friends and you're trying to be a good ally, you can do that. Literally just like, I know a lot of people, you know, don't know how to be a good ally. So simply saying, hey, I'm here for you. How can I be there for you? Or like, hey, I can't begin to understand what you're going through, but what can I do to make your day better? Stuff like that, it matters. So, you know, now is a better time than ever to reach out. But yeah, I mean, we're literally picking up pieces of our soul and marching forward.
Yeah.
It sucked.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess a version of insult to injury is like the headlines of that shooting are on the front page of sites that then are like, oh, and here's 5 more attacks that have happened. Here's, you know, a 79-year-old woman being attacked on the street the morning after. Here's, for instance, here's a screenshot for you. Man arrested in attack on Asian American woman at rally with daughter in New York City. Just to be clear, the rally she was at was against this sort of violence. So people are going to these rallies to stand against the violence and are being attacked in the exact same way. Yeah. That's Katie Hu, a 37-year-old Asian American woman. She was with her 7-year-old daughter. But neither the irony of the situation or the presence of a 7-year-old was able to stop this individual from attacking her. And by the way, in a separate attack that took place just a few hours later, a 54-year-old woman was walking home when someone approached from behind using a metal pipe to hit her in the face. Witnesses said they heard the suspect say, I'm here to F up Asians. So I can't wait to hear Tucker Carlson talk about how let's not jump to conclusions about the motives. It's gonna take more than a person telling you exactly what they're trying to do before we can be sure. And so it's like this terrible shooting. And that is the absolute high point of violence in a landscape that just, it has not relented.
Yeah, I mean, for us, I talked about this last time, but it's literally people being lit on fire, burned alive, having acid thrown on them. A 2-year-old and a 6-year-old stabbed in a supermarket in Texas. I mean, it's literally walking down the street, people getting murdered. Vicha, that's what happened to him. So there is this palpable fear that already existed before the mass shooting. And now there's this eruption because it's just so, so, so horrific. But we have been living this horror. And it is well past time for people to take it seriously. It's starting to change, you know? So I am glad, but momentum is really hard to capture. And if we don't, you know, have a very clear call to action, organize and, you know, get push it, then I am standing up at night worried about where my community is going as a movement and how we are going to be able to keep this call up, you know, so that our community is safe.
Yeah. Yeah. You talked about the possibility of progress. Let's turn to one possible area of that. So look, the violence and harassment against the Asian American and Pacific Islander community is not new. It didn't start with the attacks in Atlanta. It's not gonna end with the attacks in Atlanta. But over the past month, there's at least been a little bit of news coverage of the fact that this exists, that this is going on, which seems like a prerequisite to do something about it. And obviously there has been a lot more talk in the wake of the attacks in Atlanta last week. But has it been the most productive talk? Because you know, Media Matters noted an interesting trend to the conversation over the past week, and there have been panels about this, which is something. But the panels have often looked like this on Meet the Press, where you have a bunch of people, but none of them are part of the community. And then you even have sort of the acknowledgement of that problem by Chuck Todd saying, you know, the Asian American community has been talking about this for a year, basically, since the start of the pandemic. And it really took the rest of sort of collective political intelligentsia to take notice, sadly, after the tragedy of this week. So he's sort of talking about the fact that they've woken up, but not realizing that maybe not as much as you might have thought. And look, the thing is, we will occasionally get criticized for instance, if there's like a big piece of legislation targeting the LGBTQ community that comes out and we have a show that day, why didn't we have a guest from that community? And it's a perfectly fine criticism. I will say it's a very difficult day of for our very limited booking department to do that. For the Sunday Meet the Press, you got a lot of resources. I think it could you could probably find somebody from the community. And we have, I think, a worse version of this in just a second, but I wanted to give Amanda a chance. What did you think about this? Are we being unfair? Have you noticed more representation in the media coverage of this than I'm giving credit for?
No, you're not being unfair. It should go to say, if you're talking about hate crimes against the Asian community, and if the problem is invisibility, don't perpetuate that problem by literally not making us visible amongst the experts that you have on to talk about it. I'm only laughing because otherwise I would be enraged. I mean,
yeah,
this is what I meant about gaslighting earlier. You say you want to help, but what are you doing? You know, it's not a lack of commentators or academics or activists or influencers. We're out here, we've been saying, please include our voices. You know, who made that decision, right? Like who said, yeah, like green light this is okay. Because somewhere among them, they must have seen the irony in this. And the only way I could think about it is that somebody, there aren't enough critical voices that are holding, you know, checks to the decision makers within Meet the Press, within these outlets, because just the regular person looking at this would be able to point out what's wrong with the picture.
Yeah. Well, we've got another picture, actually, in quick succession. This is a video. We've got Chris Wallace. So this is regrettably Fox News talking, not just about the shooting, but about one specific part of this, which we're gonna transition to as well, which is the way that prominent Republicans and members of right-wing media have talked about the pandemic. And so here is Chris Wallace asking if that might have been a contributing factor to last week's shooting.
Guy, you saw that clip of Vice President Harris at the top of the segment, and I think it was pretty clear she was drawing a link between these attacks and President Trump, and especially his talk about the China virus and Kung flu. Do you think that's fair?
I don't.
Oh, he talked more, but I'm not gonna listen to it. Why is he the person that's commenting on that? And is anyone surprised that he thinks that's an unfair thing to say? Just multiple panels from companies that have massive resources that could bring anyone they want. You know who they could bring? They could bring Amanda on, actually. Amanda would come and she would talk with a combination of authority and passion about the topic. It would be really easy. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you've experienced any of the Fox specific coverage of this. I don't know if that's something, Amanda, that you wanted to open yourself up to, considering how rough the last week must have been.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I have some self-preservation in me. So I did not engage in that. But look, anyone who wants to just see what the connection is between our leaders' words and the violence that has happened need only to not only look at the data, the rise in it, the facts, the figures, but also ask the perpetrators. Some of them will willingly admit to you that they did it because the President Trump said so, right? Like the guy who stabbed the 2-year-old and 6-year-old, he fully admitted to that. So yes, there is a direct link. And also we are saying it. And please listen to us and include us within your panels. It's really simple. Representation matters.
Exactly. You know, and I wanted to finally ask you about after the shooting happened, you had that press conference with the cop, and he talked about how the dude was having a bad day, and it's You know, it's not racism, it's the sex addiction. That's what the killer told me, and I trust everything he says. And then the media started talking about it, and lots of right-wing media seemed to only get fired up about one thing. How dare you leap to the conclusion that race had anything to do with this guy driving past tons of other places specifically to kill Asian American women. And so I'm curious, like that being so much of the conversation, are you at all worried about how that might have influenced coming out of this shooting, whether they're more or less likely to happen in the future, that there seems to be so much media infrastructure designed to shield racists from what they do being recognized as such?
There are a couple things I want to address here. One is when the news was reporting on it, the first thing that I thought about beyond, you know, that question that I had to answer the reporter is at least they're talking about it, which is like so sad because we're just like fighting for scraps. We're fighting to exist. Like, thank you for covering the story of our pain. That's the first thing. The second thing is, as somebody who has lived as a woman and Asian my entire life, I can tell you that there's absolutely no question that this was racially motivated. He said that he had a sex addiction. Asian women have had to deal with yellow fever for a really long time. Yellow fever is this idea where you objectify the Asian female body. And when you literally look at a human like an object, then your chances for being violent to that human skyrockets when you dehumanize us. So the intersection of misogyny and racism is at full display here. And how the police reacted to that is also a display of a complete lack of understanding of what it means to live in this body, to be yellow, to be a woman. You know, it was so fascinating to see those t-shirts that were exposed by folks, that police officer, for folks who don't know, I think it was the police officer who spoke at the press conference,
yes,
who had these t-shirts that said China virus on them. I mean, what an end-to-end full service spectrum of how a president can say something that's racist and then that is then okayed by the state that is trying to protect us, whose mission is protect us. So when we see our leaders talk about this and when we see people who are supposed to protect us talk about this, where do we go? You know, there have been plenty of people who have had bad days and they don't go killing people. It is unacceptable. So I think we should revisit some things there.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Many people notice that in the wake of, you know, a lot of outpouring of support for Asian Americans after the violence in Atlanta, lots of people were trying to show their support. One of them was Meghan McCain, and it was pointed out that it was a little bit hypocritical considering some of her past statements in this area. We talked about it last week, but I'll allow John Oliver to sum up the issue.
Just last year, many were loudly warning that Trump calling COVID names like the China virus was likely to lead to a rise in violence against people of Asian descent. An argument that at the time, not everyone seemed to find convincing.
I think if the left wants to focus on PC labeling this virus, it is a great way to get Trump reelected. I don't have a problem with people calling it whatever they want. It's a deadly virus that did originate in Wuhan. I don't have a problem with it.
Oh, good. Meghan McCain doesn't have a problem with it. Listen not to the scores of Asian Americans telling everyone that the term is dangerous and offensive. Instead, gather around and take the word of a wealthy white woman who's dressed like she's about to lay off 47 people over Zoom. Now, I will say, McCain posted this week, stop Asian hate with three broken heart emojis, which is a fine sentiment to throw up on Twitter after the fact. But there has to be an understanding that saying, I don't have a problem with calling it the China virus, is very much giving space for that hate to grow.
Yes, so a lot of people pointed out this issue. She has eventually responded to it with a tweet saying, I condemn the reprehensible violence and vitriol that has been targeted towards the Asian American community. There is no doubt Donald Trump's racist rhetoric fueled many of these attacks, and I apologize for any past comments that aided that agenda. So progress, right? Amanda, what do you think?
All I can say is listen to the community. Listen to the community. I get it. It's really, really hard to understand in a nuanced way when you have lived with privilege your entire life. You know, and that's not to discount what actual privileged people have to go through, because everyone has their own thing. But what I'm saying is we get into this a lot with legislating, right? That like people in power who have the ability to write these laws, many of them are very well intentioned. It's not like when they write these laws, they're like malicious. However, if you don't have people at the drafting table with you who have these lived experiences, then you're gonna miss on some things. And more importantly, when people from these communities say, hey, that's gonna result in violence. Hey, we are afraid for our lives, for our family members' lives. Listen to it. You know, I'm glad that she's apologized. At least there's that. But moving forward, I think she is an example of someone who didn't listen. So,
yeah. It's such a good point. Like, imagine if, I'm trying to think of like an example. Like, I don't know, Chuck Schumer started throwing around some term about the trans community or something. And imagine if we covered it on the show and I was like, you know what? I'm okay with it. I'm good with it. What? Okay.
Yeah.
Who am I? Like, and for McCain, it's marginally worse because, you know, look, there's lots of different forms of privilege. The fact that she's a daughter of a senator and wealthy beyond any mortal's comprehension, that is another form. I'm a man, that's a different form. But like, it's not your call.
Yeah.
How could you not know? And look, it's the same sort of job. We opine about politics. You say a lot of things that you don't necessarily know 100% about, but you should recognize when you know 0% about it and that it has nothing to do with you. It's such a weird thing, Amanda.
Oh yeah, it's weird. And it also has enabled violence. So, you know, I look at that and it's been our lived experience for so long. And I'm glad that this conversation is happening because people can learn from it. It's empathy. That's the core of this is learning what you do know and also learning your boundaries of where your knowledge ends, right? And when you have that and you can say, hey, you know what? I don't know. I from my lived experience, I don't understand, but I hear you. You know, that's one way to learn, you know, and not to say like, let me just dismiss millions of people who are calling this out, even though like I haven't ever lived in your skin before. Let me just dismiss it. That's not the right
call. I think that's a great point. And you know, there's a case could be made that her in advance, well, not in advance of all the harassment and violence, it was almost immediate, but in advance of some of the worst violence is bad. Saying it wasn't racist after the violence, though, seems even worse. And while Fox spent days after the Atlanta shooting arguing that it's a travesty that people would imply that white supremacy has anything to do with this or racism has anything to do with this, I worry that they are going to double and triple down on this. They are looking for things they can activate their audience to hate. They found a few. They keep talking about women's sports as a way to activate their audience to hate the trans community. I don't know that they necessarily thought a year ago that trying to get people to hate Asian Americans would be their thing. But they want people mad about the pandemic, and they found a scapegoat that clearly a lot of racists find to be very appealing. So God only knows where they're going to turn to on this topic in the future, when and if almost certainly more violence continues to happen.
Yeah, and they're going to get a lot of help from the structural things at play that have made us a scapegoat for literally the entire existence of when Asian Americans have stepped onto this country. You know, yeah. That's a very old playbook that they're stepping into.
100%. Okay, let's switch things up and talk about something very differently, very different for a bit. You remember Sidney Powell? I unfortunately do. She became very famous in the months after the election because she was one of the most out in front proponents of the big lie that the election was stolen by insert a noun, everything, Venezuela, aliens, I don't know, a Kraken is going to be released and the Kraken is stuffing ballots. And at the time, she knew, as many who are pushing this lie, that making very specific defamatory claims about individual companies involved in the election could open her up to legal liability. And in fact, it has, because the election infrastructure company Dominion Voting Systems sued Sidney Powell, among other people, for defamation after she pushed lawsuits and made appearances in conservative media on behalf of then President Donald Trump to sow doubt about the 2020 election results. Dominion claims that Powell knew her election fraud accusations were false and hurtful to the company, both of which would be necessary for a defamation claim like this to actually work. Well, she has a defense against this now. She said that the lawsuit should be dismissed, arguing that, quote, no reasonable person would conclude that her accusations of Dominion being part of an election rigging scheme with ties to Venezuela, quote, were truly statements of fact, which is amazing. And you kind of want to pause on that, but we're going to proceed. Given the highly charged and political context of the statements, it's clear that Powell was describing the facts on which she based the lawsuit she filed in support of President Trump. That is what her defense lawyer said. And they go on to say, indeed, plaintiffs themselves characterize the statements at issue as wild accusations and outlandish claims. They're repeatedly labeled inherently improbable and even impossible. Such characterizations of the allegedly defamatory statements further support defendants' position that reasonable people would not accept such statements as fact, but view them only as claims that await testing by the courts through the adversary process. So Amanda, she is all of a sudden being very, what, me? No, those were just the things that the people I was representing were saying. I just had to put it out there for the courts to look into. I'm not saying anything as if it's true or factual, which I don't know how much attention you paid on a nightly basis to her and others' appearances following the election, but that is not how it was presented at the time, I vaguely recall.
Yeah, can I have that excuse too for like literally everything else in my life? What? I think we're living in a satire. But what else is this? It's so ludicrous to me that you can, you know, hold up an apple and say, this is an orange. You know, like we see, we have eyeballs. If anyone has had eyeballs and can hear and has seen what she has said, then they would know that she's out of her mind.
Mm-hmm. I would argue the same thing. Or at the least, she recognized a good grift when she saw one and wanted to have her grift and not be sued for it too. It is occasionally nice to realize that though, you know, I may disagree on a lot of stuff with people like Sidney Powell and others, that at the end of the day, we do have some things in common. Like I might say, how could anyone believe this garbage? It turns out she's saying the same thing. She also doesn't understand why anyone would trust her. But as important as I think this is, considering how influential she got, how many Republicans now believe that everything she said is 100% true, and they will base their future political activity on those beliefs. She is not the first to come up with this defense, as many longtime viewers of the show are probably way ahead of us on. Tucker Carlson once used this, or I should say Fox's lawyers defended Tucker Carlson this way. You literally can't believe the facts that he tells you. That's what they were saying. And the judge actually bought it in that case, saying Fox persuasively argues that given Mr. Carlson's reputation, any reasonable viewer arrives with an appropriate amount of skepticism about the statements that he makes. But even Tucker Carlson was not the first. Alex Jones, his attorneys also argued that no reasonable person would believe what he says. And in fact, he's just playing a character that's saying things. It's not true. So like you said, Amanda, it is very convenient to be able to just say whatever you want. And if anything you say is demonstrably defamatory or dangerous, you can just say, why would anyone be dumb enough to actually believe that any of this garbage is true?
They're not on Comedy Central like the Colbert Report, you know? So what does that say about their, what are they saying about the people who watch them? You know, in this, in making this argument, what they have admitted to is, oh, our audience is really gullible, and that's on them if they think that what we're saying is real. You know, and it should come with like disclaimers all around, like this is entertainment. We are not telling the truth, right? I disagree, and I have feelings about people lying to other people.
If there was, yeah, if there was like a watermark on the screen, don't trust this man, I would have less of a problem with it. But the thing, I get telling them lies. It gets you an audience, it gets you paid, it gets you influence. Sidney Powell got a billion Twitter followers like instantly. So I get why you would do it, and I get why you would use this defense. It worked for Tucker Carlson. Maybe it'll work for her too. What I don't get though is why them doing it doesn't appear to hurt them with their audience. Like, let's say hypothetically, I were to lie a ton, like a lie to the audience, and I were to someday go to court and be like, man, Dragon Squad, how stupid do they have to be to actually believe this garbage? This is an actual question to the audience. Please comment. Would you have a problem with me doing that? Because I hope that you would. Tucker Carlson's audience doesn't seem to care. Alex Jones's audience loves him as much as they did before all of this stuff. Sidney Powell probably still has a million Twitter followers. So would this bother you? I really hope that you have enough self-respect to be bothered by that. Anyway.
It's people's identity, you know? It's like you're in the hole deep enough at that point, you're just gonna go with it.
Yeah, you would think. Yeah, God. A new paper has delved into one particular set of ways that those at the the highest end of the income scale avoid paying a good deal of taxes. Now, we're familiar with other methods having to do with tax loopholes, sending your money offshore, things like that. But I want to delve into what they found recently here. The paper estimates that the top 1% of households fail to report in total about 21% of their income on average, with 6 percentage points of that due to sophisticated strategies that random audits don't detect. So moving forward, when thinking about possible ways to fix that, understand that the current system, even insofar as some rich individuals are occasionally audited and far fewer are than were just a few years ago, let alone a few decades ago, many of these techniques can actually survive an audit. For the top 0.1%, unreported income may be nearly twice as large as conventional IRS methodologies would suggest. And the London School of Economics, which produced this, says that these strategies include offshore tax avoidance, which may have waned after stricter reporting requirements took effect about a decade ago. But many high-income Americans also use partnerships and similar entities to avoid taxes, and such behavior may be increasing and becoming harder for tax authorities to find and unentangle. And so, Amanda, on the show recently, we've been talking about Congressman Ro Khanna. He has a plan to inject a bunch more money into the IRS to try to get the rates of audits of wealthy individuals and corporations back up near where they used to be. What's interesting about this study is that they show that it's not, and they say in particular, it's not just a body count of how many people we have. You need specialized agents that are as good at tracking down this tax avoidance as the highly skilled accountants hired to do the tax avoidance actually are, which seems like moving forward, obviously money's gonna be required, but it seems like the IRS has a big task in front of them if they're going to try to adapt to the way the rich have been avoiding taxes recently.
Yeah, look, I will be the first to admit that I don't know enough in order to have an informed opinion about this. But what I do know is, what do you need all that money for after you die? You're like all these people who are avoiding this. You have more than enough to do everything it is that you want and more in your lifetime and your kids and your kids after and your grandchildren. So like what is that other than like seeing a number in your bank account go up? You know, I feel like these people could buy a Lamborghini every day and just drive it into the lake every day. They'd be fine. Like it wouldn't even, like they wouldn't even know it's missing. So
totally. Yeah, the only thing I would add, devil's advocate, I think it's partly seeing the number going up in your bank account. I think more so for some of them, it's seeing the public numbers go up in their ranking amongst rich people and stuff like that, or the value of their corporation, stuff like that. Like I think it becomes, it's like, you know, in some ways people want to compete with like how nice their house looks. They compete with the people on the street. Some people, their street is the country or the world, and they want to rank really well. It no longer has any relationship to their life. Like for you and I, gaining or losing money matters. It affects how we live, what sort of possibilities we have. For these people, they could carve their face on the moon. At that point, it's not really about what you can do with your money, I guess. But anyway, yeah. And let me be the second to admit that I'm not an expert on this. I'll defer to the experts. That's why we bring on people like Rokana to talk about this, actually. But something definitely needs to be done. They become very skilled at this. It makes it seem to me like maybe an analogy is, corporations that want to harden their systems against hacking often will hire hackers or former hackers to do it for them. I feel like maybe that's something IRS could look into. Although, as already noted, not an expert.
Yeah, that'd be a good movie too. Maybe less exciting than hackers, or maybe more, depending on, you know, what they find.
Maybe there was that movie, The Accountant, and that got pretty exciting. I didn't know that accountants did that much shooting of guns. But anyway, Amanda, we have regrettably reached the end of our show. I've been watching the chat during it, and there's been a lot of great reaction to your appearance. So I want to thank you for taking time out of your what must be an incredibly busy day and joining us. If people would like to follow your work, where can they do that?
Well, thank you for having me on, and thanks y'all for inviting me into this community. You can volunteer at risenow.us. You can donate if you want at risenow.us/donate, and you can follow me on Instagram at Amanda NGOCNGUYEN, my full name.
Awesome. Amanda, thank you so much, and have a good day. Joining us now to talk about the death of Sarah Everard, a story that has made massive news in the UK, less so here in the US. And so it's important that we learn about this from someone who understands the story. We're very lucky to be joined once again by columnist for The Intercept, as well as author of Being Numerous: Essays on Non-Fascist Life, Natasha Leonard. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Very glad to have you here. So this death has sparked a lot of conversation. You had a really amazing breakdown of a number of different ways that different aspects of politics and society and the way we comment on specific comments based on the context of who's in the story all combined. Can you tell me a little bit about your interest in this particular murder?
Right, so Sarah Everard is a British woman, a 33-year-old woman who was kidnapped and murdered in London. And her remains were discovered. And so it was a kind of almost archetypal horror of a gender-based violence. And it sparked a massive response in the UK and a very necessary conversation about what was broadly described as women's safety. But a lot of the response and the shape of the response played on a lot of archetypes around what we talk about when we talk about danger that I think are pretty outdated and need to be, we need to have a critical response about. So it was a lot of talking about women in public spaces, stranger danger, the kind of horror stories that you're told about as a child, about, you know, not going home alone after dark. And of course, people have very valid fears of the kind of risk a woman alone at night can face that seem to be realized in Sarah Everard's murder. But what was missing from that dialogue was the particular shape of how she was killed. The person who has been charged with her murder is a member of the London Metropolitan Police Force. So this was also a story about who gets accorded trust and indeed gendered state violence, police violence, and also obviously the broader conversation about which murders garner attention. That's not to say something as horrific as what happened to Sarah Everard shouldn't produce rage and attention. But of course, when counterparts, women who are not white women, black women, other women of color, black trans women are assaulted in public spaces. And that is indeed a structural problem that happens consistently within that demographic. It doesn't create the sort of outpouring we saw. So what I was trying to point out is that, you know, yes, this is an unthinkable horror, but we have to think about the structures that enable and perpetuate gendered violence on a mass scale. And those include police violence. And so, you know, the answer of how do we criminalize dangers to women? How do we increase policing of it that are often the responses to these kind of horrors totally miss the point that that kind of policing and the way the state can enhance dangers to women's bodies, particularly some women's bodies, must not be overlooked and is absolutely not a solution.
Yeah, I understand the need to provide the caveat that, you know, pointing out that this sort of story does get talked about shouldn't be seen, but might accidentally be seen as disregarding that it is its own tragedy, its own horror, which is totally true. But you're 100% right that certain sort of stories just naturally produce not just recognition, but possibly a week of coverage, and other sorts of stories not so much, or they require some sort of special circumstance. Like the media might focus on violence against Asian American women if enough of them die in a very limited period of time, then it might merit coverage. But I also wanted to focus on the aspect of, you talked about it led to this conversation about what is dangerous and all that, and it seems like it took quite a bit of work for the fact that the person who did this, that might be a cop, to count as dangerous. That you almost weren't supposed to point out that, well, yeah, obviously we know that you list great statistics in the story about the predisposition that you seem to see with domestic violence when a cop is involved in this. So and it looks like in this particular case, the what happened at a vigil, which perhaps you can describe for us, that might have made that part of the story a little bit more front and center.
Right. So there was this kind of interesting shift that happened that, you know, I think was a very necessary shift, in that immediately after Sarah Everard's body was discovered, the conversation, the popular conversation, seemed to be about this woman walks alone at home at night, stranger danger, really kind of footnoting the relevance of the police in this story. But then at a mass vigil that was held for Everard in London, the Metropolitan Police, you know, the very police force that the accused murderer is part of, broke up the vigil because it had not been sanctioned. But they broke it up in an incredibly violent way. So there was this imagery of, you know, officers manhandling, throwing women to the ground in the name of public safety. And these were women, a kind of a vigil organized by an organization called Sisters Uncut, talking about women's safety, public safety, the inclusion of trans women's safety. And then it was police officers manhandling them in the name of safety. So it was really on the nose. Mm-hmm. And that very crucially did in fact bring the conversation of state violence, police violence against women into the conversation. And what's been interesting is that following that vigil and the police violence in it, we've seen the activism and the anger around Sarah Everard's murder also translate and encompass an anger about police violence and a kind of connection with the women's safety movement that is responding to the murder, activism and organizing that was already going on against a new bill that has been proposed for England and Wales that would give police really dangerously expanded capacities to break up protests. So those watching those two efforts combine, I think, has been really heartening and really important, and a really worthwhile shift away from talking about individualized safety of individual women against strangers, as opposed to state violence, and of course the far more common violence of the home and domestic violence.
Exactly. So that bill, what led to that being a thing that in theory could pass? And do you think that it is likely that this recent conversation, the shift in the conversation and how it applies to that bill, might be successful in stopping it?
So the bill is actually a really capacious bill. It's not just about protest policing, but you know, it's about resources for police in general, and it's about, you know, capabilities of police. But a very particularly dangerous, threatening to civil liberties aspect of it that had drawn attention even prior to the Everard vigil, I see as a response to the kind of protests you saw in London as well as here in the US, you know, protests against policing, against racism, Black Lives Matter protests, anti-colonial protests that you saw really take off in England, and you know, this expansion of police powers, I see as non-coincidentally a follow-up to that. So you know, the struggle against racial violence in policing is certainly connected to this. So this bill was somewhat long in the making in this last year, but anger against that sort of police intervention against protesters and their rights has really been brought to the fore after that vigil. And you know, in terms of this, it's called, you know, hashtag kill the bill, kill this policing bill. That's the kind of rallying cry, that, you know, the intention seemed to be to rush the bill through parliament very quickly. And it looks like the organizing and people in the streets in response to that have genuinely made a difference, and it's been slowed down and will be considered more slowly and challenged, I think, with a far greater degree. So I think you see the power of people really responding to this and refusing to accept this narrative that, you know, more policing equals safety, which has obviously been so much of the crucial political conversation here on the left.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and one last thing I wanted to ask you about. You referenced, as I alluded to earlier, some stats about I believe it was here in the US how you see something like four times the rate of domestic violence in households with police officers. You referenced a petition about all hundreds of instances of abuse that had effectively led to no consequences whatsoever. Do you see any indication, whether in the UK or possibly to the extent that this story is being covered in the US, that anything might come out of this socially, of recognition that this is a pervasive problem, that whether it ends up that this is what happened with that one case or not, that this link is clear, well established across multiple countries?
Yes. Yeah, so I mean, the statistics you're talking about, there have been two studies in the US that are somewhat contested, but this was two separate studies that say that, yeah, rates of domestic violence in policing families is up to four times as high. In the UK in 2019, there was a super complaint brought against over a dozen police forces referencing over 700 alleged instances of domestic abuse that led to scant consequences for the officers involved. So, you know, these are structural problems, and it's kind of, it's a very English tendency that I've seen to say, oh, the police are a problem over there across the Atlantic. That's where the racist policing exists. But clearly, as the protests of last summer showed, as the London uprisings in 2011 made clear, this is a problem in both nations where policing exists as such. Is there going to be a reckoning? I think the uprisings of 2020 show the need for that reckoning and are the burgeoning of that long overdue and long fought for reckoning. Do I think the response to the policing of Sarah Everard's vigil and the activism in the UK right now will be, you know, the end of it and the necessary turning point? No, this is a really hard fought, almost Sisyphean task, but you know, it's, I think, really impressive the amount of ferocity and potency that we're seeing in the actions against policing as an institution.
Agreed. So there's a lot of different elements that we're talking about here that we've touched on. But if anyone watching this would like a lot more detail, Natasha's article is up at The Intercept. Search for women's safety movement sparked by Sarah Everard's murder should focus more on cops in the home. You can get way more detail there. And Natasha, we want to thank you both for your work on The Intercept and also for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.